Welcome to the podcast, Didn't I Blow Your Mind This Time? The podcast where my co-host and I pick movies and try and blow each other's minds with our picks as we trade them back and forth. I'm sounding a little rusty, and I think it's because this is the first episode of season two. Lex, am I sounding rusty?
No, you are spot on, Duncan. You don't like my David Lynch voice? Get used to it.
I haven't even introduced the movie yet. Ethel Merman's in the studio today.
Oh my God.
I feel like I really need to hit the premise of the podcast because oftentimes I'm on the street and someone will say, listen, I listened to Didn't I Blow Your Mind This Time, where you and your co-host pick movies to blow each other's minds, movies that the other person has not seen. But I don't understand. The movie you did last week, Cape Fear, wasn't even particularly obscure. And I have to explain the reasoning is the movies, the only prerequisite has to be that the other person hasn't seen it.
That's it. It's just that simple.
It's that simple. So I hit that particularly hard on this episode because our movie is not some little under the radar title. It is David Lynch's Wild at Heart. And my jaw dropped the floor when I heard Lex had not seen it.
You know, I have lied about having seen this before. It seems like a movie I should have seen before. I have not. Frankly, I think it took me way too long to even see Blue Velvet.
Wow. Listeners, if you could see my face, you would see I am not impressed. You didn't go see Blue Velvet like Jesse Eisenberg with Jeff Daniels in Squid and the Whale?
I remember my parents talking about having seen it and just not knowing what to make of it. And then I remember my parents talking about having seen Wild at Heart and just once again not knowing how to handle what they had seen, but really being struck by Willem Dafoe's character and performance as Bobby Peru. And it was
impossible
sort of this.
Impossible not to be.
Those are dummies.
Dummy. I mean, it is fantastic. But then I think about, you know, if Twin Peaks was my David Lynch immersion, that's what kids were watching at the time. Can you imagine if a show like Twin Peaks had the reach that it had on ABC in whatever, 1989, the way a show might now and reach kids? Like, it's a bygone era. I think
it's another time. Yes, I was a big Peaks fan, and I'm giving you a little gruff, but I also don't remember my whole Lynch trajectory. I remember Blue Velvet being on a lot of top 10 lists as the greatest movie of the 80s. I think I'd seen it on HBO late night. I don't think I got a lot out of it besides being terrified. Yes, huge Peaks fan. Later, a little baffled by Fire Walk With Me.
I like Fire Walk With Me.
That's the great thing about Lynch. You can be very baffled by his movies and kind of go back, dip in again, and you see them in a whole different light. They are often very difficult. And that's why I was, to be quite honest, you made a confession. Now I'm going to make a confession.
Uh-oh.
I was very nervous about picking this film. I may have even over-prepared, as you can see the stack of books on my desk.
I was nervous. I did the same thing.
Well, I didn't want a bunch of dumb David Lynch hot takes out there on the internet for people to ridicule me with. So I don't think I saw Wild at Heart in the theater. I believe I watched it in college many times in some ridiculous film class. And I rated it in my mind as kind of like mid Lynch.
Okay.
And I have to say, having not seen it in many, many years, rewatching it for this, I was surprised. I'll unpack that. I was surprised by my reaction to it.
Well, what it certainly is peak Lynch. It's like height of powers Lynch. Twin Peaks couldn't have been hotter. In 1990, Wild at Heart, off the Lynch machine rolling, won the Palme d'Or. not without its fuss. There were vocal critics. Roger Ebert. No surprise.
No surprise. Roger Ebert, famously not a fan of Blue Velvet, although later in life he did come around somewhat to the film.
As he was wont to do. I mentioned that in a previous podcast that he did not like Pulp Fiction, but then came around after multiple viewings. One of those viewings was with me, naturally, in a shot by shot breakdown in 1995 of Pulp Fiction. But again, I'm rewinding to old episodes of Didn't I Blow Your Mind this time? And if this is your first time joining us, you need to go back to get a flavor of what's going on here.
Oh yeah, don't just dive into the deep end with episode one of season two. Really go back and savor those old episodes. Well, let's talk about the origins of Wild at Heart just for a second. So Lynch had shot the pilot.
Yeah, those books you got there stacked up high beside you.
He'd shot the pilot for Twin Peaks and had a few other projects, his dream projects that he was really excited to get off the ground, Ronnie Rocket and Once in a Bubble. Both were kind of casualties of a bankruptcy of Dino De Laurentiis's company.
Yep. He was tangled in with Dino since Dune, I think. But Dino managed
to... Doing the Dino dance. You get burned.
The Dino Dune dance. I think Dino paid for Blue Velvet, right?
Right.
Which was shot in North Carolina. I don't know if Dune was shot in North Carolina. But so Dino had... a studio that he set up, and he probably had tax breaks in North Carolina in the late 70s and into the 80s, and it fueled a little boom there in North Carolina for a tiny version of now what's happening in Georgia, and it's part of why there's a pretty decent film school at UNC. I want to say Greensboro, and one of your favorites is an alum there, David Gordon Green and Danny McBride.
Danny McBride is Dino, one of
the direct line from Dino to Devo. I don't know. You're pretty vocal about not liking David Gordon Green, and I haven't quite
you're gonna
nailed
cut,
down.
You're going to cut this out of the podcast, right?
I don't know.
I don't really remember that. This is odd. I wish I was in with that cool David Gordon Green, Danny McBride. I mean, let's set the record straight here. Danny McBride is
not Danny McBride.
Pajamas to me. When I did meet him one time, obviously we can't have an episode where I don't name drop. But I went to a party at Walter Goggins' house. This was after the premiere of Vice Principals. Well,
you know, I've met Walton as well.
Oh, you met Walton as well? Okay. Oh, sure. Interesting. All right. Well, anyway, I was at the party at his house. And I didn't really know many people. I might have imbibed on a little bit of a J. And because that's the go-to if you don't know anyone at a party.
Take that's little, the first thing you should do.
A little toke of a stranger's joint. And then next thing I know, I'm looking real cool, just studying the spines of books.
Oh, boy.
To no one. But I think I'm in kind of an empty room. And then I hear a toilet flush. And behind me, Danny McBride just like saddles right over. He's like, find anything good? Rolling over to the nerd at the party. Yes. And whatever I said was
paranoid.
Whatever I said was not cool or fun. I don't remember saying this about David Gordon Green. I'm a fan of All the Real Girls and George Washington. I may have maybe thrown
you
a
said
little
something
shade
about
because he's so
remakes.
Commercial now. Okay. Yeah.
You
I guess
said
I
something about keep
Halloween.
Your paws. David Gordon Green needs to keep his paws off of some version of some remake. And I'm forgetting what
it is. I
think The
Exorcist, maybe.
Oh,
I don't know.
Is that happening?
Martin Scorsese needs to keep his hands off a remake of The Exorcist. That's hardly a negative. I think you're
okay.
You're causing,
I just took it.
Trouble where there is no. Yeah, you definitely took that wrong. Okay, so let's get into it. So yeah, Lynch's pilot of Twin Peaks has been shot. A couple projects with Dino aren't going anywhere. His friend and the associate producer of Twin Peaks, Monty Montgomery, handed him a book by Barry Gifford, Wild at Heart, the story of Sailor and Lula, that Monty wanted to make into a movie as a director with maybe Lynch producing. And then Lynch was like, hold it. This is right up my alley.
I want a piece of it, Duncan.
And what I found so interesting, I didn't know this. I know Barry Gifford's work. You know, they went on to, I think he co-wrote Lost Highway with Lynch, and they worked on a couple things.
Oh, is that right?
But I didn't know he's the founding editor of Black Lizard Books. And I love Black Lizard Books.
Tell me
famously
more.
The independently run publishing house that has revitalized interest in so much hard-boiled noir fiction in the 80s and the 90s. So to me, like, I was like, hold it. He was the founding editor. I would have thought he was just one of the authors. I guess they did publish a couple of his books as well. So he had a foot in publishing. And I think I read he was in France and saw some out of print books, maybe of Jim Thompson, and thought, hey, this is something we should be republishing in the U.S. But so many of my favorites, Jim Thompson, David Goodis, Charles Williford. I'm actually reading The Shark Infested Custard right now. You know, so many great books. So I'm very, I'm kind of intrigued by Barry Gifford's whole trajectory right now.
Yeah, we were in a serious noir renaissance in 1990, thereabouts. There was just so much hard-boiled crime, so much noir. It's just sort of everybody involved with this had some other version of, a hard-boiled Jim Thompson-esque crime project. It's just seeped into all this stuff. Plus so when Lynch got out of De Laurentiis's sticky fingers, he got into Propaganda Films, which is that's the company that made this, and they were spun out of the big commercial directing and music video crew that was happening there in late 80s, early 90s, and Fincher was
in
among
LA.
Them.
Oh, Fincher, yeah. and videos.
Uh-huh.
Funny
uh-huh.
you mentioned that. Fincher and I worked together.
Is that a segue for you?
You know, Fincher and I worked
into
together.
Into another name drop?
Well, I can't ever not. It's not.
There
even
was
on...
no room for, no interest in my Walt Goggins story, I'll notice. Okay, go
circle,
ahead with your
we're
Fincher
circle
story,
back.
Which
well,
we may have heard before.
You're an act. I don't think so. I don't
okay,
think so.
Okay, hit it.
It's not even a story, but it's not even on IMDb, so I have to bring it up anytime that I did work with Fincher on Videosyncrasy, aka Living on Video, a half-hour Fincher pitch-black comedy for HBO, seven episodes of which were shot. I wrote the episode that all takes place at Rod Stewart's house during an all-night party. And I never even got to go to set. I was all excited to go to set. I was on another show. I was on Blunt Talk with Patrick Stewart and was all excited to go to set for my episode and found out the plug was pulled on the show. NDAs were signed, but I'm not saying anything out of school because this was all on Deadline Hollywood. Just outrageous. And I've never seen any footage and hardly anyone has except for Aaron Sorkin.
I guess
Fincher.
That was like, I feel like I should have been wearing a bulletproof jacket from all those name drops. Just pop, 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 pop.
All right, that's it. And I'm going to make a promise to the listeners that I'm not going to name drop one more time.
Oh, well, I will. Just right off the bat, just to clear the air.
Okay, so Lex, what's your Walter Goggins story? I just figure you're both from down south. You're both thespians. Like, what's
well? First what's of all, I knew that his name was Walton, not Walter. But we'll just leave it.
Oh my God, this is another reason I was ostracized at the party. I like rolled in. I'm like, what's up,
hey, Walter?
Can I get a hit of this dude? Nice books.
I will. No. I don't want to mess with your flow. You were. I don't even know where we were. We've just been furiously fighting over who can name drop first. So, you keep on with the Barry Gifford because that's where we were.
Well, his name's Barry Gifford. But anyway, someone didn't do a lot of research. Anyway, I don't want to get into too much setup of this movie. I just wanted to say that was something interesting to me because I love so many of those books. And then I picked up and I'm a couple chapters into Wild at Heart and really enjoying it. And unlike many authors, I think it's refreshing. You know, so many novelists, you read the story, oh, I hate what they did with my movie. Barry Gifford, there are many differences, and we'll talk about some of them, many differences with Lynch's movie. Of course, if David Lynch is going to adapt your movie, there are going to be some differences. Barry Gifford was very excited about it, and obviously they've worked together a couple times. But I just think it's interesting that Lynch was the pilot to Twin Peaks was shot. And then when they're editing Wild at Heart, they're editing that and the first couple episodes of Twin Peaks. So it's a really a mad dash to get this to Khan. And even the night before, I guess they usually do the 5 minute tech test with the film, but they hadn't even seen this particular cut of the film. So Lynch left a party on David Bowie's yacht, rolled into Cannes, and made the projectionist, you know, screen the whole thing for him at 3 a.m. so they could at least see the movie before it was screened whatever the biggest theater is at Cannes. With jeers and cheers, but you don't want to be met with just cheers at Cannes.
No, you don't. And what I was going to ask is, was that the cut that was the X-rated cut? So it was among the first cuts of the film. So it had to have been, right? It had to have had some of the most gruesome violence that didn't make it all the way.
I believe so, but I don't think it had all the most gruesome violence because the first cut of the movie was 4 hours long.
Oh.
And the scene that, at least from my limited dunk dive, the scene that sounded the most violent that was taken out was the scene where Harry Dean Stanton's Johnny Farragut character is captured and he has his
tortured.
He has his head blown off. And then his killers are like making out and doing kissy face over his bloody
so that makes
neck.
A lot.
It makes a lot of a sense lot of because sense. That
it's just a cutaway now.
Part of the film feels a little truncated. So they had two test screenings. Yes, David Lynch does test screenings. And both times, they're just people were like leaving the theater in droves, and Lynch was like, hold it, I think maybe we might have gone a little too far in that scene.
Cut the making out over the blood spurting. All right, should we get into it? Because
let's get into it. Let's
we don't
get
have
into
all
it.
Day.
We have you. I hope you blocked off a few
we
hours.
Have 4 hours.
Yes, let's get into it. But with a Lynch film, we're not going to, go. And we never really do go scene to scene. We're just doing our impressions. This Lynch makes dreams. And we're going to talk about our impressions of this fever dream called Wild at Heart. And I say fever dream because it starts out with a fire.
Oh, that's true. That's true. The lighting of the match. And then we're in Cape Fear, North Carolina, Duncan, how did you plan it? Getting us back to old Cape Fear again. One of our premiere episodes of season one, and he brought it back for
it's
us.
I'm all tying in, and it's all very rewarding for the hardcore blowheads out here, seeing all the connective tissue. And I've got to say, this opening, This is a bit of a jaw dropper. Glenn Miller's In the Mood is playing, and we're in this beautiful, see this beautiful staircase in some kind of country club.
Yeah, and it's very Southern. It feels like we're immersed in a very specific type of Southern society, high society, and then it goes more South very quickly.
It gets very south. We see our beautiful, our stars, our Laura Dern, who's worked with Lynch before, Nicolas Cage as Sailor, who hasn't worked with Lynch before, but there is a short...
That performance piece, right?
Yes. Somebody did a little research. Okay.
Well, I could tell you a lot more stuff. I could get a word in edgewise.
I didn't even realize. Okay, please. Unpack this performance piece, because I...
No, actually, what I wanted to ask was, what... Was Laura Dern in Blue Velvet? What was she in before?
I love that. Educate like me. this has become a Q&A where I'm like asked these questions. You're like, so what was the budget for the movie? Yes, Laura Dern was in Blue Velvet.
Okay, I'm just saying. You know, it's been a while. I might have to go back to Blue Velvet as well.
Yeah, you might have to go back to that. I might have even revisited it before this episode.
Oh my god!
Holy cow! Yes, this is. I mean, Laura Dern and is Lynch's, you know, probably his closest collaborator. Threw her no nudity clause to the wind for this film because she trusts Lynch as a director. And I'm not going to name drop again, so I won't even say, but somebody was walking down Sunset Boulevard. Okay, I was driving. I wasn't walking. Where I used to, you know, I used to live right by where Lynch was, did his now it's become almost famous, his photo opportunity, grassroots Oscar campaign with Laura Dern and a cow.
Oh, yeah, of course.
For Inland Empire. And I was like, boy, I drove by that. Did I not have a phone? I guess I didn't have a cell phone at that point.
It was an all day.
That would have been a nice picture.
Yeah, it was an all day affair. I remember that. It was
right driving by. It wasn't like the, you know, the traffic was stopped or anything.
Yeah, and the only thing better than David Lynch, shouting to passing traffic is David Lynch on a bullhorn shouting to passing traffic.
For the young kids out there, that's what LA used to be like. David Lynch would be with a cow on the street with Laura Dern and just be like, huh.
And that was right down the hill from his house. And the only reason I know that is because I've been to his house at a Christmas party hosted by him, shook his hand, said hello, but I'm not name dropping. There's no room for this right now. Hello, Lex. Merry Christmas to you.
That was good.
And also, it just happened that Sissy Spacek and Jack Fisk were there, who I know from back in the day when I was in high school. Their daughter was in Annie. I was Rooster in Annie in the high school performance, and she was, of course, Annie. So, you know, I was a bit of a star in the Spacek Fisk eyes. You know, I'm not making a big deal out of this at all. Of course, they were glad to see me because it had been a few years, Duncan.
I bet. Did you have your headshot on hand just to jog their memory?
So good to see you. Thanks for having me. Where should I put this 8x10 manila envelope? Should I just sit it by the door with 5 headshots in it?
Believe me, if Laura Dern was there, I would have been like, oh, Laura Dern from New Blue Velvet. Not like, oh, it's Laura Dern from Jurassic Park, which was probably the faux pas you made.
No, I was like, oh, Laura Dern from Smooth Talk with Treat Williams. Nothing. Okay. He doesn't even know what Smooth Talk is.
I don't know what Smooth Talk is. Joyce Carol Oates story? I know what Smooth Talk is, buddy. I know what Smooth Talk is. That was Smooth Talk.
It's a great movie. I watched it recently.
Very good film.
That was my research, watching Smooth Talk.
All right. I'm not even going to get into my Treat Williams story.
We're 2 minutes into the movie.
The movie story. I wanted to talk about the opening because it is so jarring. We have barely seen our two stars, Cage and Dern, as Sailor and Lula, before they're approached by a character who taunts Cage, pulls a knife, and Cage beats the living hell out of him.
Yeah.
The music goes
from
big band to, I don't know if you call it heavy metal or industrial metal. And there are two really, really disturbing shots of Cage beating this man's head against a wall and then against a floor. You're like, wow, that's a lot. And then he keeps beating his head.
And I mean, I was excited when this moment happened. Just that juxtaposition was thrilling. And right off the bat, you're like, oh man, this is a David Lynch movie. And he is not wasting time.
Marietta tells me you've been trying to fuck her in the tortoise for the past 10 minutes.
Oh man.
Crazy fucking bad boy. Trying to fuck your girl's mama. Now tell me, how that cute little cunt Lula feel about that?
Uh-oh.
You know, Marietta just gave me this to kill you. And after she said Lula was mine, I only went, oh, yeah.
But you have to think that opening alienated so many people. I mean, people must have been running for the aisles at that opening because you don't even know the characters. You don't even know if you like them. You literally know nothing.
No. What you do get a sense of in that moment is the... This is actually what I love about this movie is he comes on strong with relationships and then doles out the backstory in measured ways. I mean, piecing together the backstory is going to be part of what's ahead, but the instant antagonism between Nick Cage and Diane Ladd is phenomenal and gripping, and that's what you're kind of locked on right away, this relationship between the mother, the daughter, and the boyfriend. And then of course the Elvis level point that Nicolas Cage does at Diane Ladd after the murder has taken, or the killing has taken place. That really sets the tone as this like rebel without a cause in an alternate dimension. And you're really like, okay, this is what this movie is going to be right off the bat.
Yeah, you've got this explosion of violence, but then you also have this kind of fun shot of Cage pointing at Diane Ladd up the staircase, where he's almost striking this Elvis pose. Diane Ladd, obviously Laura Dern's mom, who's in the film, who gives arguably the best, most memorable performance.
Yeah,
I said arguably because this is a film chocked full of great over-the-top performances. And one thing I was reading about Diane Ladd and how much she loved doing this role and how much fun it was to work for work with her daughter. And she really is one of the great Lynch villains. And I thought it was really interesting that in all, or at least many of the different scenes, she said that she was trying on she thought her character was someone who didn't know who she was having an identity crisis. Obviously she has Marietta, the mother character, has mental problems, and in a lot of the scenes she is doing a twist on a big Hollywood star. So like one scene with the martini, she's doing a little Carol Lombard. Another scene when she's crawling towards the Harry Dean Stanton detective boyfriend character, she's channeling a little Lana Turner. And that was something that kind of helped her make the character even more over the top. And all the characters in the movie, really, the main characters are, as in with many Lynch movies, kind of channeling these older stars, these archetypes. So Lynch very much, for the Nicolas Cage character, was pushing him towards just kind of...
Elvis, James Dean.
Exactly. And as we know from Twin Peaks, obviously, you know, he Lynch loves James Dean, loves these kind of larger than life 50s Americana apple pie type archetypes. And with Laura Dern, I read that one of the key words was bubblegum. He wanted her to be like the personification right. of bubblegum. And Dern and Cage went, I really like this. They went fun method. They were like, they weren't being like, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis dicks about it, but they were just having fun. And If you're Cage
or
Dern, I mean, you're watching the movie and I want to be them so bad.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also, by you bringing up Twin Peaks, there's a bigness, that works better than Twin Peaks in playing with the Hollywood, archetypes and cultural iconography, all that stuff just works better in Wild at Heart because it is a movie and not a TV show. And so the effect is more instantaneous and sort of, again, like alternate dimension. You know, if this is like this is like a fever dream version of a 50s or 60s or like early 60s big Hollywood movie.
And I, for me, I think I said that Wild at Heart kind of felt like mid-level Lynch, at least my memory of it. You know, for me, you know, Blue Velvet's kind of at the top, and Mulholland Drive after many viewings is maybe under that, even though I feel like now Mulholland Drive is almost thought of as his ultimate
It is amazing. Masterpiece. It's the one I go to in my brain. You know, it ranks the highest for me. And then Inland Empire is the one that continues to scare me and mess with me. I feel like it's the most challenging. It makes sense that maybe that's where he's left off. I don't know, forever or for the time being, not sure. But
were you with me seeing Inland Empire at the ArcLight Cinerama Dome?
Maybe. I feel like I saw it for a film festival, and
it was at AFI. Okay. I was there. Lynch was there. And he was so jazzed. And he
said, "Hey, Lex, I see you in the back row there.
Still got your headshots from your Christmas party."
Yep, here they are. I'll get to you.
He was so jazzed about digital video.
Oh, that's right.
He was so jazzed. And you know, everyone in the audience thought, here comes the kind of a third wave of Lynch films.
Yeah.
He said he was never going to shoot another film not on video, and I don't know, maybe he didn't like the way the screening went. I'm not sure. But I was riveted for the movie. Yeah. I haven't revisited it since then.
I mean, it's a tough one. I feel like maybe all I need to do is see it once, but we'll see. I'll get back to it eventually.
It's a tough nut to crack, but let's get back to this nut.
Okay.
So for me, the first third of the film works best when we are with Lulu and Sailor, and kind of luxuriating in their love for each other.
So here's what I want to bring up about them as characters, and exactly what you're talking about with the bubblegum fun of them. I, you know, in this first part of watching this movie, I was realizing, oh my God, there was so much Bonnie and Clyde story happening in the early 90s. Natural Born Killers, California, True Romance, Freeway. I mean, honestly, there were times here where I thought, you know, this felt like Cape Fear if Juliette Lewis had run off with Robert De Niro almost. But what I noticed as the most effective out of all those movies, Wild at Heart felt like I really understood the notion of two lovers so entwined and so innocent, and that the world around them is corrupt and hellish in a way that those other movies just don't pull off. Maybe they're not trying necessarily to pull off, but the version of that Bonnie and Clyde story where you're totally in this, right in the heart of a pure love story, I feel like this is the most effective version of that. And it definitely has to do with their performances, but also for the first half of the movie, the treatment of the characters. I mean, all we're doing is they're basically on the run and having sex and partying, and they're not confronted with the creeps that are after them.
I think first you read a script and or a book, or you get ideas and you begin to fall in love. And at the same time, you feel a thing in the air. And the thing in the air is always changing. And something about the thing in the air verifies your love, or you kind of goes against it. And in this case, it went, you know, with it, the thing in the air. And so it felt correct to go forward. Wild at Heart was all about an extreme, a crazy world, crazy activities, you know, things just coming apart. That was really in the air. When I finished reading Barry Gifford's book, it married itself with this insanity sort of that was in the air. Things were kind of flying apart. And I love the idea of a love story in the middle of an insane world. So yeah. Everything was kind of out. And but Sailor and Lula were very much equal, one to another, the man and the woman. He respected her, she respected him. I liked that in the middle of this crazy modern, you know, thing. But they were with each other. They knew what they wanted, and they were together.
There's a lot of sex in this movie. They both look gorgeous. And the creeps in this movie are so creepy. Cage and Dern are so hot and so gorgeous, and everyone else is such a grotesque.
And it really does start with Diane Ladd. I feel like the it's you see her, and she has such power just with a look at the top of the stairs there, and then through the first bit of backstory, we find out that she is responsible for the death of Laura Dern's uncle who raped her. So we know that she's a formidable power and can get things done. And it's only as we get to know her more, we understand that in a way she's sort of like a society kingpin with all these resources of violence at her fingertips. But just looking at her is disturbing. And it's weird that, you know, the first transition has a Wicked Witch of the West crystal ball transition that establishes this Wizard of Oz thing. But when you first see Diane Ladd, she actually looks like Glinda the Good Witch, and yet she's the bad witch.
When you check this film out, you'll see her mom in the film also.
My mama playing my mama, and she is the wicked witch extraordinaire in this film.
Yes, this movie is peppered. The whole Lynch oeuvre is peppered with Wizard of Oz references. This movie probably has the most overt Wizard of Oz references.
For sure.
I want to thank my friends at Janus Films for just to pat myself on the back for all the homework I did, for sending me a secret screener of Lynch Oz, which played at Sundance but isn't out yet. And I thought, how can we discuss this movie without me having seen it? I just got it yesterday. But Lynch Oz is very good. It's a collection of film essays that all have to do with Lynch and his obsession / love for Wizard of Oz. And when I watched the movie, I was actually expecting there to be a lot more Wild at Heart than there was.
Yeah.
But because there's so much Lynch that dabbles in Wizard of Oz, you know, it's just one of many films. But a few things: Amy Nicholson, name drop, who I do know, who also does one of the essays, the great film critic, talks about Wizard of Oz being part of a cultural consciousness that stems from America's more golden era that we think of, or at least a time when we all had pop culture collective consciousness and touchstones in a way that we don't now,
right?
Because things are so fractured, and that Lynch is able to use Wizard of Oz as almost like this nostalgia pushing button in a way to affect an audience. And I thought that was interesting.
You know, people can see something in the dark that they can never see anywhere else, and it's thrilling to the soul. That's the idea.
And it seems like just from an elemental structural perspective, hopefully I'm not getting this wrong, but the reason why it shows up in such a big way in this movie is because of Lynch's decision to have a happy ending. And he's kind of backward engineers the use of the Wizard of Oz into the rest of the film. So at the end, Gifford wanted the lovers to not get back together, and Lynch felt like they needed to get back together, and that there was basically, he would use a deus ex machina character in the form of Cheryl Lee as the Good Witch to bring them back together, and then decided to, you know, filter that in from the beginning.
Yeah, I like that Barry Gifford has said that Lynch took elements of the book and escalated the violence and the perversity, but at the end of the day, the ending, which Gifford thought should stay dark, Lynch right. wanted to give a happy ending, which feels very Lynchian in a way.
Yeah, right.
So the first draft of Lynch's script for the first adaptation of the book, he banged out in a week. Like I said, there was a lot. It feels like there was a real time crunch on this movie. Even the first scene that we talk about how jarring it is, the original 4-hour assembly that very few people saw, that scene came later in the movie. So that was not the initial opening, which makes sense. Now, I'm not sure if the flashbacks were part of the chronology and then they became flashbacks later. I don't know, but it doesn't really feel like the opening of the movie as much as I like it because it's so bizarre.
Yeah, I love it. And I could agree with that, but I feel like I've never sort of been thrown into a movie quite like this before. And I'm happy to have seen it. I gotta say, as challenging as Inland Empire felt because it was so long, and maybe I would feel the same way in a 4-hour version of Wild at Heart, I'm now definitely intrigued by what the 4-hour version is.
Yes. I mean, this 4-hour version, I hope I'm not misspeaking, is almost like an assembly that was that was just put together. This is not out there floating around. Don't look for it. I wonder if the most violent Harry Dean Stanton scene with Grace Zabriskie exists. I would love to see it.
Well, can we get into Harry Dean Stanton scene?
Let's get into it a little more because it's not long after we meet our main couple, Lulu and Sailor, that we meet a second couple in terms of Diane Ladd's Marietta and her very interesting friend slash boyfriend slash whipping boy slash detective Harry Dean Stanton in a role I love.
I could have watched a whole movie of just those two, I swear. That scene in the living room was so gripping and modern, even though it feels like a bygone era and the characters feel like they're from a movie from the 40s. And yet the power between them is so authentic and so real and so dangerous and confusing, and it's just all of it that it's so watchable. And god damn it, Harry Dean Stanton is just so good. He just continues to be amazing every time you see him.
He's so subdued, he feels so real. If he never made another movie, you'd be like, oh, this is just some guy Lynch grabbed who's playing himself,
right?
So the hound dog face, the wrinkled suit, he's so in love with her.
And so in love
and so ready to do whatever, you know, whatever she wants.
I'm sorry I'm fast forwarding, but there's sort of a bookend scene between them that happens in New Orleans with that same level of connection and she's just using him and spinning around him like a top, just pulling all his strings, and he knows it, and she basically wants to save him from the death that she's unleashed on him. And his eyes well with tears when she brings up how, you know, wouldn't it be great to get away and just be in love and basically be what Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern are. And the emotion that's in his face is so incredibly moving. It was a joy to watch.
A joy to watch. And I would have loved, I couldn't help wishing that there was a Harry Dean Stanton scene with Cage and Dern as well. I imagine that
he'd be on their
maybe
side.
Maybe that was in that 4-hour assembly.
He's got this innocence and naturalness that's really rare.
and he says a line, and you hit. It's just real. It's so phenomenal. And what he does in between the lines is incredible. A lot of people, you can sort of see them. They're not really listening. They're not within the thing in between the lines. And you can see them start thinking about their next line. Just a subtle little thing. Not Harry. You watch him in between the lines. He is there. Whatever there needs to be, he's there.
But yeah, in quick succession, we're introduced to a lot of new characters as Marietta defies Harry Dean Stanton's Johnny Farragut detective, sends him on his way to, you know, go find the AWOL lovers. But at the same time, she's calling her other kind of, man Henchman's on the side, Marcella Santos.
Played by J.E. Freeman.
Who in turn is ringing up a character called Mr. Reindeer, who orders up a hit on this couple while he's on the toilet.
Yeah, that's W. Morgan Shepherd. That guy is amazing. He's like a Shakespearean actor who's been in like Star Trek movies, and he's phenomenal and a face that you recognize. And his character is tied in with all kinds of other New Orleans lunatics like Calvin Lockhart and Grace Zabriskie, and just the slew of weirdos that just unfurls as a result of J.E. Freeman getting involved is. I mean, that's what I'm here for when I'm watching a Lynch movie.
I love it. I love it. But at the same time, a lot of these weirdos feel like they are not given their due. It's a little truncated. We're jumping around. We're seeing them. At the same time, we're seeing Harry Dean Stanton driving his car, listening to "Baby Please Don't Go," intercutting with that. It's everything's a little little jumbled.
Yeah.
It's a little
I just want to say about J.E. Freeman, who plays, you would remember him as the Dane in Miller's Crossing.
Okay. Now I do. Didn't know who he was.
That, I wrote it down. I was like, I realized that all I want is to have a role, have like two roles in two great movies like J.E. Freeman does. Like, that's it. That's all he's got. And you're just like, that guy was great. That's a dream.
You heard it here, Hollywood. You heard it here. Still angling for that David Lynch role.
Just give me two roles in my late 50s, and I'll be happy.
You want me to shoot Sailor in the brains with a gun?
Yes.
In the forehead?
Yes.
Wrong. It's always better to blow a hole through the back of the head, right through to the bridge of the nose. Lots of irreparable brain damage.
See? I knew you had it under control.
You're a little slow, but you're beginning to get it.
So we meet a lot of weirdos, and at the same time, we're also peppered by a lot of these flashbacks. The flashback that explains Lulu's sexual assault at the hands of her uncle, who is I didn't even look up the actor, but it's that guy who is on Mel's Diner, Alice's Restaurant. I just love that they use the most milquetoast kind of sitcom actor. And he's so blank-faced that it's really upsetting. It's a very disturbing flashback. So, we have we're meeting a lot of characters in quick succession that are part of this ninth circle of hell of oddball assassins that are after Sailor and Lulu. And at the same time, we're also meeting a lot of oddball and disturbing characters through flashbacks that are coming at us, both explaining Lulu's and Sailor's backstory, but also the story of their most recent backstory of how they got to be on the run from her mother. So there's a lot coming at us. And Justus Neeland, who's a David Lynch essay, or Wild at Heart essay I read in his book of Lynch essays talks about the radio as the overarching metaphor for this movie. And there are old-timey radios are coming fast and furious in this movie. What is Nicolas Cage is like exercising with one or stretching over one in one scene, using the cord to like stretch out his legs.
Yeah.
And there is something about this idea of the bad air and the toxicity all around them that is being tuned in and out. And there feels like there's a radio wave type of motif going on with the sound design, and the Lynch sound designs are always so wonderful and over the top and usually loud. There just feels like there's also something with Lynch and his love of meditation and transcendentalism and kind of catching the big fish. If you've read that book, I'm just going to flex every Lynch book I've read that feels.
Have you read his this. Autobiography?
This is the one that he wrote with Christine McKenna, Room to Dream. I've got it right here.
Yeah. Well, you might want to return it because I recommend the audiobook, which is narrated by both of them separately. And his chapters are just a total joy to listen to as he... McKenna gets into the raw facts of his biography and brings up, you know, some of the questionable things and digs deep and you know, gets into the tough stuff. And then when it's David's turn, he just is happy to think about all the delightful things of his memory. He's just like, I remember on a sunny day, the coldest Coca-Cola you can ever imagine with the sweat on the bottle. It was just nothing has tasted better. So anyway, that's the way you should consume that book.
Can we say you're a creature of habit?
Yes. Habit in a daily routine.
Yeah.
And then when there's some sort of order there, then you're free to mentally go off any place. You've got a safe sort of foundation and a place to spring off from.
Yeah. And you view that in terms of the creative process as very important.
It's very important for me.
For you?
Yeah. Right.
You don't like a cluttered room when you're thinking.
No. The purer the environment, the more... you know, fantastic the interior world can be, it seems to me.
Let's have a sidebar here for a second.
Okay. I do have something about the radio, though.
Go ahead.
All right. What I noticed about the radio is in the scene where Laura Dern kind of flips out because it's all bad news on the radio and she can't find a good station, I felt like that is exactly where Lynch lives. Like, that's the greater Lynchian theme, which is that about the Coke, the thing I mentioned about the Coke, he loves perfection and he's always grappling with the ugliness of the world, and finding how those two live together in one world is kind of his constant effort and why things are so disturbing. I mean, he loves the idyllic world, and Wizard of Oz factors into this. His what he says in his autobiography about his sort of perfect childhood. He's always striving to get back to those places, but that also creates a heightened awareness of what he knows reality is actually like, and the dirtiness, and he almost obsessively pursues, you know, the disgusting aspects of human nature, and his sort, I guess his way to gain control over them is to put them next to each other, and try and figure out what their relationship is. It says, Lula says,
it's just shocking sometimes when things aren't the way you thought they were.
That's as a result of her freak out about the radio. And I just feel like that really is the ultimate Lynchian theme.
The radio scene, which is probably one of the more better known scenes in the film, does feel like the terrible pun, linchpin of understanding the movie.
Yeah, it's true.
This idea of all these horrible, grotesque stories that they can't escape on the radio causing them to pull off the side of the road and then engage in this kind of sexy freeform right. dance. And the camera goes into this beautiful crane shot that calls attention to itself as the music shifts. And there's something about, their love. It's kind of them against the world. Right. Their love is their best armor against the defense of this crazy, awful world that is, to quote Laura Dern's character,
this whole world, wild at heart and weird on top.
And one good example of weird on top is when we go from the line, more than a few bad ideas out there. And the next shot is Diane Ladd smearing lipstick all over her face. So her face is entirely bright pink red with lipstick. It's one of the more terrifying images in the movie. And there's some gnarly stuff in the movie already. Oh, and then we have Crispin Glover as Jingledale.
Well, hold on a second. I mean, that might be its own podcast right there. But yes, the Diane Ladd with the makeup on top, disturbing. An echo of Dennis Hopper with the lipstick on his mouth before he kisses Kyle MacLachlan, the white pancake makeup of Robert Blake in A Lost Highway. Lynch loves, like you said, he loves the rot behind the beautiful veneer, and it feels like sometimes when characters act out, the carefully construed makeup starts to go a little crazy on the faces, and you're getting these close-ups where you can really see the foundation and the cosmetics. I feel like that's something he really loves.
That's interesting. I never noticed that before, but yeah, totally true. Crispin Dale as Jingledale, though, making sandwiches and putting cockroaches on his anus. That was like a Lynchian topper for me. I was like, this is totally delivering.
It's almost, this is a flashback with Lulu telling Sailor about her cousin Dale. And we see these, I think Crispin Glover only has one line, and the scenes, it's like four or five little scenes, probably only last a minute and a half. It could be its own. It's almost like a short film, this movie. If ever Lynch was going to do a spinoff of any character, it should be
Jingledale.
It is so great. Crispin Glover is such a, he's unforgettable in this
film. Oh my gosh.
And I read he was, as you could guess, he's such a Lynch fan, saw Eraserhead a gazillion times at the New Art here in LA, and later Lynch produced Glover's film What Is That? So it was great.
Did you see that?
This hero. I did not. I remember when it was playing in LA, and he was doing public appearances. He was taking it around to theaters, roadshow style.
Yeah
I don't think there was like a real in distributor.
His classic Bentley. I feel like I pulled up to a stoplight one time next to this old gorgeous Bentley, and I thought, well, this is going to be somebody interesting. And I turn and look, and there it is. It's Crispin Glover.
It doesn't get any more interesting.
Nope.
I did not see that movie. I think there was a sequel too. And I can't say I'm running out to, don't even know where I would run out to see this movie. did not sound like my cup of tea.
My cousin Dale was always fighting bad ideas. See, Dale loved Christmas. We used to call him Jingle Dale. He wanted Christmas to last all year long. He sure would scream out when his mama told him it was summertime and Christmas was 6 months off. And also, he would say that he felt those men with black rubber gloves was following him around. Dale said that trust and the spirit of Christmas was destroyed by ideas being controlled by aliens wearing black gloves. These aliens would get Dale to do all kinds of things. Then he'd carry on about the weather. Talk about how rainfall's controlled by aliens living on Earth. Aunt Rudy told Dale that one day he would realize that the alien wearing the black gloves was him, and him alone.
Well, it sounds like old Dell's more than just a little bit confused, Peanut.
Well, Dell was learning a hard lesson. It got so he'd stay up all night making sandwiches.
Dell, what are you doing?
I'm making my lunch!
Mama told me, Aunt Rudy, that's Dell's mama. Found cockroaches in Dell's underwear. One time, she found Dell putting one big cockroach right on his anus.
Hell, Peanut.
It ain't so funny now, though. Dell disappeared.
There's also, speaking of that scene with the lipstick with Diane Ladd, she finally ends up, I think, throws up. And that's when we see that she has Wicked Witch of the West curly shoes. It's getting more overt, the Wizard of Oz element, as we move deeper into this hellscape.
Yes. And I hope that I finished this thought that Lynch's first pass of the script, first draft of the script done in a week, did not have any Wizard of Oz. And then he did another draft. He felt like this draft was too dark. And it was he added some Lynchian nuggets, a little bit of Lynch dust over the original script. And that's where the real Wizard of Oz references came in. So that is not something that exists in the Barry Gifford novel.
And it does sound like, yeah, there was constant rewrites happening, because I watched an interview with Cage talking about the snakeskin jacket, which is such a big part of his character, and that he had picked up that jacket on Melrose at a thrift store and thought, oh, wow, I would really love to. Such an actor move. I would really love to wear this in a movie. And the next movie to come across his plate was this. And he was like, hey, David, you know, I've got this snakeskin jacket. I'd really love to put it in there. And Lynch said he would think about it, and then came back to him later. And that's where the monologue about the jacket being an emblem of his commitment to freedom and individualistic expression, all of that came out of the jacket, and Nick Cage being like, I'd really like to wear this jacket, man.
And it became apparent to me that the characters that you remember more than any others are the ones that really kind of have one wardrobe and they stick to it. You know, it becomes their identity almost, like a second skin. And I thought, well, let's bring these kind of concepts back and let's have Sailor wear the snakeskin jacket and not really wear anything else. Just he's got the snake jacket and the black jeans and a t-shirt, and that's his symbol. And that's really the genesis of that. That was the idea, was to make it a more strong image.
I love that the jacket is representative of his individualistic expression. That's an echo of one of the most popular archetypical characters of all time. It's fantastic. It's hard and to that imagine really does, him without the jacket.
Speaking of this kind of coming at a time that kicks off all the Bonnie and Clyde stuff in the 90s, I feel like this was the kickoff of Cage's Elvis stuff, because Honeymoon in Vegas came later, and then his unashamed obsession with Elvis came after this, I feel like. But also it was showing up everywhere in the 90s, and including True Romance, and then whatever that Costner Kurt Russell movie was. Didn't we see that?
3,000 Miles from Graceland. I yeah. never saw that.
Oh, you didn't? I did. It's not good.
Nick Cage's obsession with Elvis culminating in him marrying Elvis's daughter?
Oh shit, I totally forgot. Wow. Yep.
Little on the nose. Yep. Little on the nose, Nick. I'm only thinking now that I really have no idea what Tarantino thinks about this movie and if this was an influence for him. I mean, True Romance came out not that long after, I think 93.
Reservoir Dogs was 92.
Kicking around, so.
Yeah. It was.
I don't know if it was an influence. I know he's the Lynch fan. He was not a fan of Fire Walk With Me, but
I think that it was kicking around for a while. They were trying to finance it and direct it themselves, I think, him and Avery. It probably might have preceded Reservoir Dogs. Don't quote me on that. But also, I do the parallels between this and Cape Fear are, I don't know, they seem pretty significant. It was only a year later, but I don't know. I guess I can't account for it. I'm not necessarily trying to say that Scorsese was influenced by this movie, but it is kind of weird how many elements there are that cross between, you know, the dream. I'm thinking of the stage scene where in the high school, which feels nightmarish in that way. And then, you know, the criminal clashing with the teen daughter, and then the whole Cape Fear of it all. Okay. I don't know. It's not strong, but it's interesting.
So this film, to me,
you want to talk about this movie?
This movie really kicks in for me into
an hour in,
into high gear, into some of my favorite Lynch. Once we roll into Big
the Studio. the second round of weirdos, the weirder weirdos.
I mean, there's obviously,
name them off.
There's been so many amazing things that have happened in the film already. To me, like we've talked about, I'm really the two couples have resonated with me the most. And Lynch has said that, you know, one of the reasons he was drawn to the book wasn't the weirdness, wasn't the craziness of the novel. It was the romance, the fact that Sailor and Lulu were really equals. Lulu is very much treated as an equal. She's almost the brains of the operation a little bit. And I love that. And their love really pops off screen. I also love right before Big Tuna, the sequence with the cage and Lulu picking up or almost picking up Cheryl Fenn in the car accident. Yeah. The horrific car accident. And that seems to be where it almost reminds me of the Isabella Rossellini naked scene in Blue Velvet, which I read later was based on a Lynch childhood memory. I wonder if this accident is based on something that really happened, because it's kind of comes out of nowhere. Not that there's not a lot in this film that comes out of nowhere, but he really takes his time with it. It feels so nightmarish, and it's the moment in the movie where Sailor and Lulu's luck seems to run out a little bit. And then we find them in Big Tuna, which they need to get some cash. Nicolas Cage is checking in with his old friend, Perdita Durango, played by Isabella Rossellini.
And are you going to do this or am I?
We might be revisiting. I don't think we should tip our cards, but we might be revisiting this character later.
Yep, that's it. Foreshadowing an upcoming potential episode.
And Isabella Rossellini has a very interesting look in this. She and Lynch had been talking about maybe getting a character that almost played with kind of a Frida Kahlo with a demented look. And so she's in this and she looks really interesting, and Lynch and she were having a romance. They were a couple at this point. There's another Cape Fear glue for you, because I believe before this she was romancing Martin Scorsese.
Oh, is that right?
I don't know if it was right before this.
There it is. It's Rossellini. That was the connector piece I needed for all of this, my whack job theory to make sense. But what I was going to say is I feel like her character is kind of undercut by the Grace Zabriskie character. I mean, I guess it's sort of inferred that they're twins or something. Which is the connection between New Orleans and Big Tuna, Texas. But I don't know. It's just like the impact doesn't quite hit as hard when you've already seen Grace Zabriskie, who is crazier and, you know, more dynamic on screen than she is. I mean, Rossellini's still interesting to watch, but she's no Zabriskie.
I I would agree with all that. Maybe there was something going on behind the scenes in the romance that, this scene got truncated. I don't know. But Lynch.
That's a weaker theory than my cape here.
Lynch, love and the lack of rears its head.
It'll do in things many in Big Tuna, Texas.
On a set. So Lynch later took up with this film's, I believe, the assistant editor. They were married. Everyone. Okay. Eventually, so love really bloomed. Now, for Rossellini, she said that, David has this incredible sweetness, but after he completely cut me out of his life and left me with a phone call telling me he never wanted to see me again. I didn't see it coming and it was shocking. There might be something I did or something he saw in me, or maybe he just lost interest in knowing me. Sometimes I wonder if the fact that I wasn't meditating was one of the reasons he left me. I tried for a while, but I could never do it. I'm Italian. And in Italy, we're tormented by Catholicism. The Vatican may be allergic to anything spiritual. So, and she was very, very broken up by this breakup. So David Lynch, he'll ghost your ass.
Sure will.
So we're in Big Tuna, and that brings me to the part of the movie that really I just love. Lulu and Sailor check into a motel, and there we are in the courtyard to this motel.
I knew this was just Duncan fodder right here. As soon as I saw Pruitt Taylor Vance, I was like, this is where Duncan lives.
Well, to me, this was – the oddballs and the many different fun Lynch characters that have shown up throughout, like Freddie Jones. This is where it really feels like it congeals, and there's a synthesis with the plot in a way that the other characters have felt a little more like they are just kind of floating in and out of scenes because and this part of this last third of the movie, it feels like, the stakes are high. We know where we are. We're not cutting back and forth so much.
Right.
And it's this great marriage of this modern noir crime plot with Lynch operating at the height of his powers with all his oddballs and all types of bizarre sexual digression. So yeah, you've got Pruitt Taylor Vince is there at the motel, and then everybody's favorite Jack Eraserhead Nance rolls over with his bloodshot eyes and dark circles under him for this little dog monologue. And then arguably the biggest baddie of all time in a Lynch movie.
Who else
is there? John Lurie?
Yep, John Lurie, and then Frank Cullison, who's you've seen a million times as, I mean, when does that guy not play a weirdo? But yes, enter right after two strange-looking strippers, then walks in Bobby Peru.
And Bobby Peru is played by Willem Dafoe. He's got these amazing, revolting, stumpy teeth. He's dressed in black. His hair is greased back. And he ignites the screen.
Bobby Peru, just like the country.
Bobby just rolled into town a couple days ago.
Yeah, Bobby here is the most exciting item to hit Big Tuna since the 86 cyclone sheared the roof off the high school.
You from Texas, Mr. Peru?
I'm from all over.
Yeah.
Dafoe is absolutely terrifying. And there is a scene where, again, we're drifting into sexual assault territory here. There is a very interesting scene when Sailor is out checking the oil on the car. Lulu is inside her absolutely revolting motel room. We realize she is pregnant, and Bobby Peru comes in. He needs to use the bathroom, the doorless bathroom, and then later has a exchange with Lulu as he's touching her. That is a different type of assault, but very much a really disturbing, upsetting assault scene. punctuated by him doing this almost kind of corny vaudeville dad joke.
Yeah.
That feels like, to me, Lynch at its best. Right. Disturbing, punctuated by humor, but humor that doesn't alleviate the tension, but ratchets it up.
Yeah. Plus the teeth. Like, everything that comes out of his mouth just sounds 10 times more disgusting because of how he's working those prop teeth that are just fantastic. He looks like, you know, the villain in a silent era movie.
Someday, honey, I will, but I gotta get going.
And then the Defoe character, Bobby Peru, and Nicolas Cage conspire. Cage is drawn in to Bobby Peru's plan to rob a feed store for $5,000.
Which I found it strange how similar that robbery scene is to Raising Arizona. It's a hayseed bank, and they're wearing like full-size pantyhose on their head. It looks like it's like a dark version of the Raising Arizona robbery scene.
All right, you hayseeds, it's a stick up. Everybody freeze. Everybody down on the ground.
Well, which is it, young feller? You want I should freeze or get down on the ground? Mean to say, if I freeze, I can't rightly drop. And if I drop, I'm going to be in motion. You see?
Shut up!
Okay, then.
Everybody down on the ground!
But I will say that this is where it started to meander for me.
Look at us. I'm buckling in from like, all right, this movie has just literally caught fire. I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, it felt like the jail stuff felt like an inevitability. I was definitely surprised by cutting to 6 years later and that.
Well,
scene.
Now we're out of Big Tuna. I was saying the Big Tuna sequence was, to me, this movie at its best. Yes, after the robbery gone wrong and Cage's arrest, and we cut to 6 years later. Sure, now we're winding down.
And then we, it feels like an inevitable conclusion. I don't know how I feel about his choice to keep them together in the end. It felt, I think I lean more on the side of the book of, it doesn't seem realistic that they would stay together in this way. I mean, it is very, a fairy tale choice.
Boy, Ken Burns is upset that Wild at Heart isn't realistic enough.
I don't know. I mean, there's something to seeing that arc all the way through, that they had this amazing love affair that was totally innocent, and it's about corruption of that, and that if they walk away apart, that it doesn't ruin their innocence, but it does make them more mature and maybe more ready for the world that exists. I didn't necessarily feel good about them being together at the end. It just felt unrealistic. So
this couple that's the only shining light and the only thing decent in this whole movie, you want to see them break up and you want to see Laura Dern's mother, the Wicked Witch, win?
Well, she doesn't necessarily win, but, you know, they're just wiser because of the journey. I guess I was more afraid of what they would be like as a couple together.
It seems like they'd be a great couple. They lie around in bed having wonderful conversations, talking about their unpacking their baggage and banging away.
Yeah, but not after 6 years in jail. They basically look at each other and can't figure themselves out who they are together.
Nicolas Cage already had a stint in jail. He already had a stint in jail.
22 months. It just makes 6 years and then a kid.
It just makes the sex hotter.
I don't know. I'm not sold on the ending.
Okay. Well, and we should say for the ending, there are Wizard of Oz, our Wizard of Oz references go through the roof as there's a visit from the Good Witch.
after a bizarre street fight. I did like that.
It was great. A great
And fight. The run, the La La Land run across over a traffic jam as he runs to get her back. I did like that aspect. That was really cool. And yeah, Cheryl Lee as the Good Witch was, didn't see that coming.
Sailor.
The Good Witch.
Sailor Ripley, Luna loves you.
But I'm a robber and a manslaughterer, and I haven't had any parental guidance.
She's forgiven you all these things. You love her. Don't be afraid, Sailor.
But I'm wild at heart.
If you're truly wild at heart, you'll fight for your dreams.
I think there might have even been a similar debate or similarly other drafts of True Romance where the couple does not survive. I think maybe even Christian Slater's character dies in the shootout. And that would have been disappointing to me too, because I love the ending of that movie. I guess we're really finding out who is a romantic and who is
a realist.
Just a bloodthirsty, cynic.
No, True Romance, if they die, yes, that's a bummer. But I like the idea of these two characters having to go on in the world. I tell you what, I would be interested to see a sequel to Wild at Heart, to the book, to find out, you know, where these characters might go and how their paths might intersect again. I just feel like they needed some time in the real world apart.
Well, that's you're in Duncan. Luck, because there is a sequel to the book. I believe
I believe there's
three of them.
What? And, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you can buy them all as one. But I'm reading the book right now and enjoying it.
Oh, I'm going to do that.
You should do that. Report back.
This is a happy ending after all.
Now, I have one question before we get to the question.
Okay.
David Lynch.
Yeah.
How much, if any, of his persona do you believe is artifice?
None.
Oh, okay. Good. I like to hear that.
I think he's a true original.
I agree.
I think he is complex, and that's what makes him so interesting. I know you. There's plenty of stuff out there. There's great clips of him. You know, he does the Daily Weather he was doing for a while, which is so wonderful. I don't know if he's still doing that, which is all delightful.
He is.
Clearly, I love listening to every word that he says, but also, you know, he, there's plenty of clips of him on set where he can feel dangerous on set. And I don't think he really hides that. I think it's more how people react to the sweeter side of him. And maybe they can't reckon with the angry side of him that appears every now and again. But I think as deeply as he's into transcendental meditation, he feels pretty sort of holistically himself. So to me, he strikes me as an authentic character.
I agree. I'm a big fan, and it's interesting you brought up him on set. All the behind the scenes footage and documentary stuff and stuff I've read about Wild at Heart. He runs a good vibes set, supposedly. Now maybe he's not always putting out the good vibes, but he doesn't like other people's bad vibes. He wants to keep things very free. And Wild at Heart seemed like a really fun set. Lots of joking around. A couple times different actors and Lynch tell the story for the Crispin Glover sequence where Laura Dern's telling the story. And for a couple other scenes, he and certain members of the crew had to tie handkerchiefs and put on sunglasses around their faces because they couldn't stop breaking and cracking up. And they didn't want the cast to keep breaking up. So that happened a couple times. And I loved hearing that. And I love the stories about him, you know, setting up for lighting something. And all of a sudden he's like, yeah, this is good. But hold it. I want to shoot this like insect crawling across the wall for 20 minutes, which can be frustrating if you're an actor. But if you're in the Lynch world, I think you just have to, clearly you just have to trust him. And he keeps the set loose and the digressions coming. And I love that.
I think, yeah, I think that is it. Once you step onto set, you're in his world, and you kind of need to trust that he will guide you through whatever this vision is. And I mean, to be clear, when he lashes out at people that I've seen in those behind the scenes things, it's because people are messing with the art, or they're trying to undermine the good vibes or the vision that he is setting out. And he has his limits and he puts his foot down, and that's what it's usually about. It's like, no, don't undermine what we're all trying to do here, based on some technicality that doesn't apply.
You know, it's an intuitive thing. The film talks to you. And the story talks to you. And so it's a little bit action and reaction. You know, you're experimenting as you go to get the thing to feel correct. And how come it has to feel correct to me? And so you work and work until it does feel correct.
And Lex, I have one more question for you.
Oh.
Wild at Heart, worth the wait and blowing your mind or not? And yes, listeners, we have dropped our Bickle metaphor, Bickle Scanners metaphor. It's been too confusing for a lot of you small-brained
people
out there. No, it was a thing on a thing.
Consider me a small-brained.
It was a thing on a thing. I'm happier. We were just having a casual conversation. And as listeners know, mind-blowing and not mind-blowing does not mean whether a movie is good or bad. It's just a certain intangible metric that we employ.
That
on the
said,
show.
Calling something a Bickle is a fun thing to say. Now, I would not call this movie a Bickle. Which
we wouldn't call it either, because we've gotten rid of that. We've gotten rid of that. That was a conversation we had with.
I'm segueing. This. I was thinking about this again, I'm sorry, in the same way I was thinking about Cape Fear, which is that if I had seen it at the time, it would have, I wouldn't have known what was in front of me in a way that, you know, this has been a part of culture and a part of the Lynchian history for so long, and that's hard to shake, but I'm so glad that I finally saw it. What puts it over the top for me are the weirdos. You know, all these supporting characters to see them live in that Lynchian world that he creates. It was just so much fun. I would say, like you, this isn't among the top of Lynch for me, mainly because it's him using kind of a traditional framework of the road movie and the Bonnie and Clyde and the bad guys chasing the rebels. I think as a result of that, it has to force itself into something, and maybe if that stuff went away, it could be more sort of holistically itself, the way some of his other movies are. But it was just a total pleasure to watch, and my brains were definitely blown at certain parts throughout the movie. Overall, it doesn't have the impact for me as a Mulholland Drive or Inland Empire, but It was a great watch.
Yes, your brains were blown like Bobby Peru after a feed store. We could have used Peru. Could have been our new language for.
Well, this
for
is that, the beginning of season two.
No, I think like my old PE coach used to say, "Kiss, Duncan, kiss. Keep it simple, stupid. Let's just keep it simple." And for my own analysis,
that was after you said what. He was like, keep it simple, stupid. Don't kiss me.
He was like, why do I have to have this kid in pee? He was like, you are tall and really bad at basketball. Only one.
Yep, me too.
Yes, for me, a lot of things about the movie are not my favorite Lynch, and I agree. There's something. It feels like for the first half, it's kind of this uneasy marriage of the source material and the wild Lynch we know and love. But like I said, once they get to Big Tuna and Bobby Peru enters this movie, I feel like it's a great push and pull. I feel like that the Lynch magic is kind of harnessed in this more traditional noir crime story in a way that makes me wish the whole film had been a little bit like that. But that kind of comes up with some of my favorite. It gives us some of my favorite Lynch moments of all time.
You
can't deny the love story, even though clearly I love the love story more than you do, because you don't want to see them together at the end. But I
like
I don't
the
know.
Human story,
time.
Not the love story.
I had a great time with this.
And I do, want to bring up again what you said about that first scene on the stairs. That, to me, was like, that was what it was all about for me. I mean, just the fact that the opening scene blew my mind with the industrial metal and the beatdown that happens is just totally shocking. And that's a great example for me of these scenes that just shocked me.
And I want to bring up one more time, David Gordon Green, big fan. I've got a script circulating Hollywood right now, so I don't know where Lex got this idea. Big fan. Pineapple Express, love it all. I think David Gordon Green, didn't he do the pilot for Vice Principals? So he's already come. I was at the premiere. I'm surprised we didn't meet.
Oh,
so,
oh my gosh.
There's a just lot
a,
there.
A one,
there's a lot
two
there.
Punch. Well, this was a lot of fun to talk about.
I look forward to the next episode. And I do want to say, hey, if you're listening to this podcast, yeah, we make buku bucks doing this, but we'd also love it if you left a review on, I don't know, where do you leave reviews for these things? iTunes?
iTunes, and you can star it in Spotify. There may be other places you can leave reviews. Go ahead and find them and let people know that you love this podcast.
All right. Well, this guy's going to skedaddle and hit the WGA picket lines.
Do it.
WGA strong,
that's
everybody.
Right. See ya. Getting up, boy.